I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the challenges confronting redevelopment in Indianapolis and the opportunities those challenges present. We'll discuss what it takes to revitalize a neighborhood or bring a building back to useful life. We'll talk about all of this with my guests, Maury Plambeck of the Indianapolis Department of Metropolitan Development, Michael Osborne of Near North Development Corporation, and Joe Witsit of the Witsit Group. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, the day's news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about redevelopment in Indianapolis. I'm fortunate to have as my guests Maury Plambeck, who is the director of the Indianapolis Department of Metropolitan Development. I was saying off the air that whoever came up with that title clearly didn't work in radio. Maury, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you here. Michael Osborne, who is the president of the Near North Development Corporation. Michael, good to have you here.
Good afternoon, John.
Thank you. And Joe Witsit, who is a developer with the Witsit Group. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, as we were noting it before we went on the air, this is a relatively broad topic. We can go in a lot of different areas. I think what I'd like to start with are first sort of defining what are the real challenges when it comes to redeveloping parts of Indianapolis. And Maury, I'll start with you, Maury Plambeck of the Department of Metropolitan Development. What are the challenges, at least from the city's perspective, that you see?
I think the biggest challenge is with redevelopment. You're talking about parts of the city that have had people or businesses leave. Mm-hmm. And so changing that mindset that's once again a viable area is really difficult. And the bigger problem right now is the residential part in how do you get people to move back into the neighborhoods that others left in the last decade.
Well, and we've had some success. Presumably you look at, the downtown, really just north of downtown, obviously that area has become tremendously gentrified. What were, in some ways reclamation sites before now are upscale housing. What was the key there?
Well, actually, one of the neighborhoods that you're probably talking about north of downtown is Fall Creek Place.
Yeah.
And it's even many people think it's a gentrified neighborhood. It actually isn't. Mm-hmm. There was a grant that we received from HUD several years ago called a home ownership grant. And the idea was to get homeowners to come back to neighborhoods like that. It had a vacancy rate of 80%. Most mm-hmm. of the lots didn't have houses on them. So the part of the requirements that were that half the houses be for low to moderate income families. But the idea in our planning was that you couldn't tell the difference, that you have a mixed income neighborhood that has market rate housing and low to mod housing. And that's why we believe that was successful. Another point that we think it was successful is we built upon the history of the neighborhood. The mm-hmm. housing pattern was the same as it originally was. We kept the streets, we kept the alleys, we kept the walkability of the neighborhood that was important to its success 100 years ago.
So why isn't that model more easily replicated elsewhere then?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is we certainly got federal funds from mm-hmm. HUD that helped mm-hmm. that. The original grant was $4 million, and that's a real catalyst to help us out. The other is that the economy turned around and mm-hmm. and is not housing here and throughout the country just hasn't been successful like it was when that project was going on.
Mm-hmm. Michael Osborne, you approach it from a slightly different perspective. What do you see as the challenges to redevelopment in Indianapolis?
Well, actually, a different perspective. Our organization serves a very small, geographically defined area, mm-hmm. so we're very neighborhood-based. So the things that Maury mentioned in terms of success, we think are critical, we have to incorporate them at our scale in a different way. So I think the diversity
could you,
that
could you explain that a little bit?
Well, we're I think at the city level, there's bigger factors, there's a bigger scale. We look at block by block, where perhaps the city looks at the east side, the north side, you know, your perspective, or maybe the altitude you're looking at it from, right? we're at the 2,000-foot level, and Maury's job is to look at it from the 30,000-foot level, and that brings some different perspectives to it. But the diversity is critical in our housing revitalization efforts. We try very hard to make sure we can serve from very low income to quite modest income folks, because the diversity in a neighborhood is just as important as the diversity within a city. Mm-hmm. From that standpoint, I think the other thing Maury mentioned that we try to incorporate is that idea of kind of a critical mass of change. Fall Creek, you know, where 80% of the properties were empty or vacant lots, you know, it was remaking, albeit following a sort of neo-traditional model. It really was the ability to completely remake an area, not sort of Band-Aid approach something. And so at our level, we think about that in terms of doing more than a few homes on a block, concentrating a couple million dollars worth of redevelopment in a few blocks. Obviously, that's not the scale the city has to look at, but the principles, I think, from strategic to tactical still apply.
We are talking about redevelopment here in Indianapolis. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Joe Whitsitt, I want to talk with you a little bit about what you see as the challenges, and frankly, since you are a developer, what sort of redevelopment projects appeal to you or draw your interest?
Well, thank you. We're primarily a housing developer, and it's rental housing that we develop. We really like the urban core development. Historic renovations of buildings it's one of our favorite things to do. Converting old buildings, warehouses to rental property, or old apartment complexes, revitalizing them and bringing them back. We do some new construction, but not a lot because it's not as available in the urban core. When you do new construction inside the city, one problem everyone runs up against is the environmental issues in, you know, just that it's everywhere, probably across the country, but certainly in Indianapolis, groundwater contamination and things like that you just have to deal with. When they used to demolish homes, like in Fall Creek, in the 70s, they would just push those homes into the basement. And so you end up removing a lot of debris when you try to build in town. But those are all minor construction issues. Probably the primary thing we're seeing now is as a place like Fall Creek gets developed, which is beautiful now, and it is a mix of incomes. It's not completely gentrified. The retail development and commercial development has not followed. And certainly it doesn't lead in it.
Why is that?
I'll say, and I'm not a developer of commercial properties and I don't own retail stores, but I think it's easier and more profitable to build a big box store, number one, much less a big box store in Fishers or in the suburbs than in an inner city area. The demographics of the inner city, a lot of times it doesn't meet their requirements of income levels and population base. I think that's the primary reason. I worked on the Legacy Project a lot for on the east side for the Super Bowl, and they've developed some really nice housing, some very qualified people out there in the neighborhood, develop nice housing and nice retail space. The housing's full. The retail space is still vacant. Most of it, I think, is. And it's too bad that we can't attract or incentivize developers to come in or retail establishments to come in. The money is there for the capital to build housing more so than for the retail side.
Are there places, Maury Plumbach, I'm going to come back to you. Are there places in the country where that is being done successfully? Are there other models, or is this just a challenge that is perplexing everyone?
Well, it's been a challenge here for many years. Our Division of Planning has done a lot of studies and had discussions with retail developers about why they aren't coming back into the older part of the city. And one of the things they tell us is the density just isn't high enough. However, it is happening in some other cities, and it might be because they had a better core of retail development in the first place.
What are some of the
cities? For example, Columbus, Ohio has the Short North, which has a lot of a lot of small shops, and it's a great little walkable neighborhood, somewhat like Broad Ripple is.
Yeah.
But they'll have a lot more of them than Indianapolis has. Cincinnati has a lot of those, and a lot of other cities do have that. That's the one thing that I think is different here. We just don't have a lot of those little walkable neighborhoods. Now we're starting to get them on near the Legacy Project. Mm-hmm. East 10th Street has that potential. Fountain Square is certainly turning into a lot better walkable neighborhood for the residents down there, and we hope more will happen.
And are there ways? I know one of the ideas that they had for years was to use sort of targeted tax incentives or credits to get businesses. The term I think I've heard most frequently is the idea of enterprise zones, where you'd say if you'd come and relocate a business here. Was that effective? And if so, why aren't we still doing it or doing more of it? And if not, why wasn't it?
Well,
I'll start with Maury.
We did have one enterprise zone in Indianapolis, and that actually expired several years ago. Its main focus was on industry, getting mm-hmm. jobs in the neighborhood. And I think what we have that's closest to that is the creation of redevelopment areas or mm-hmm. economic development areas. And they're this targeted mm-hmm. planning process that helps provide incentives for areas that haven't had any new development, or for some that might be having a little, but it's still struggling. And so over the years, we have I think over 25 redevelopment areas, and we're in the process of working with the City County Council to create some more, and that's also working with neighborhoods to do that.
Well, and Michael Osborne, I'll say we probably ought to take a step back in this conversation and just say, why is redevelopment important in the first place? What are the benefits? I realized as we started talking that I'd probably jumped a couple of pages ahead in the script here. So,
well, I think from a very big picture standpoint, redevelopment is important because by its nature, it's reusing assets. You know, the streets are here, the water lines are here. Those things are all in place. So to build more new out and out abandons what you've got. It's sort of a waste of that current asset. Same thing with housing. There are opportunities here. So to reuse land, to reuse the assets you've got of any kind is important at the very macro scale, certainly.
Now, is the process, since your focus is primarily on neighborhoods, mm-hmm. one neighborhood, mm-hmm. specifically near North, is, in terms of the process of redeveloping, is it important to start the process by saying, well, you know, why did this neighborhood falter in the first place? Why did people leave? Why did these buildings get to the place where they are? If you've got an 80% vacancy rate, mm-hmm. why did people leave? Do you ask those questions? Or
yeah, certainly do. But also, I think understanding that times change, too, you could say that I guess this is the answer to your question, that,
yeah.
you know, neighborhood retailing worked well years ago. The model of consumer purchasing, where they go, you know, how they work far away, they may shop near where they work versus where they live, et cetera. So I think we can say, in part, the dynamics of the marketplace have changed, too. So to go back to entirely replicate the world as it was 40 years ago isn't possible. So we can look at why did people leave or what's affecting this neighborhood, but you don't want to just really focus on replicating the way it used to be. You have to sort of adapt
to...
Well,
I would assume you'd have to figure out that there was a problem that created that in the first place, identify it and figure, okay, how could we meet that need so that they wouldn't leave? Is that...
Yeah, so certainly understanding what those issues are. We struggle with a lot of abandoned, blighted homes, as neighborhoods across the city do, and that's a big dynamic. And so, in revitalizing it, it's one thing to build a new home or renovate something for a new homeowner, but you have to address the blighted home next door as well, from a very practical standpoint. What's driving people away, or what's keeping them away? How can we address those?
Maury Plenbeck, you have a point you wanted to make.
Any planning program in a college throughout the country will say the basic reason that people left was the creation of the automobile. Mm-hmm. It made it, once everyone could buy cars.
And we're not going to get rid of those things, right?
We're not. But once you could buy a car, you could move further away from dense development or from industrial development or you could just simply buy a new house that was better. Mm. And certainly that's what happened here. And it's even happened in the last 20 years, because you can buy a new house that's bigger and as cheap as any of the inner city houses that have old infrastructure.
We are talking about Indianapolis redevelopment here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Maury Plambeck, who is with the Indianapolis Department of Metropolitan Development, Michael Osborne, who's president of Near North Development Corporation, and Joe Whitsitt, a developer with the Whitsitt Group. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about Indianapolis redevelopment. My guests are Maury Plambeck, director of the Indianapolis Department of Metropolitan Development, Michael Osborne, who's president of Near North Development Corporation, and Joe Whitsitt, who's a developer with the Whitsitt Group. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Keith, who asks, traffic in and around downtown along residential streets can have a seriously detrimental effect on their livability, walkability, and attractiveness, especially for families with small children. College Avenue between downtown and 38th Street and Central Avenue south of 38th Street are particularly bad. These streets are wide with not very many devices to control traffic, allowing drivers to drive well over the speed limit. What can I, as a homeowner along one of these streets, do to make the traffic more resident friendly? I think, Maury, that one's probably pitched toward your wheelhouse. Maury Plambeck.
Sure. There's a couple of things. Certainly, there are discussions about changing College to two-way in different parts of it. And so in that case, College working with your neighborhood leaders and also with the city county councilor for that area is how that would happen. The council is who changes that. But it's really kind of a problem with all of the one-way streets that are outside of downtown. And some of the things that we've done in, as the department and also Public Works has done, is do traffic calming. And so a prime example is on Delaware at 16th Street, where Public Works just put
that in. That term is traffic calming?
Traffic calming. And so you make the sidewalks closer to each other at the intersections. Most people that are driving their cars complain about that because they have to slow down to get through that intersection because the lanes are narrower. But that's the whole idea, is to slow the traffic down, because we all know wide streets with little interference do make people drive
faster. Oh, pretty
much
screams highway you know, hit the accelerator. And I think if I remember, and I'm drawing something from years reading back, I think that was one of Jane Jacobs' arguments in one of her books, is that the one-way streets, which would line up with what Keith was saying, actually were a detriment to livability in cities because they just made the traffic patterns such that it discouraged walking and discouraged neighborhoods. You're nodding your head,
well,
Michael
Osborne.
All,
I guess it changed from streets as a way to get around a neighborhood to how quickly to get through a neighborhood. This way, you know, one-way streets make it really easy for folks who live far away to go through very quickly to somewhere else. You know, it's not about where you go between, it's from here to there, you know, the endpoints being the important pieces. So that's, as I understand it, one-way streets are a good way to get people out of your town faster, which is what you don't want, or get them, you know.
They
get
don't
them
linger, and they're not, and that also discourages the retail and all of that. Joe Whitsitt.
Yeah, I was going to say another huge benefit of the traffic calming, as you, now that you know what it's called, as you drive around and see it, is the landscaping that goes on into those areas with the trees and the shrubs and the flowers really brings back the feel of a neighborhood instead of a four- or five-lane road or highway, you feel like sometimes.
What did, in relation to this, we probably also ought to talk about, you know, one of the newest features in the city, the bike lanes. Does that enhance redevelopment or revitalization of neighborhoods, particularly since basically, we're operating with the same amount of road, we've just grafted a bike lane onto it. Michael Osborne.
It's a traffic calming device, too, isn't it?
Yeah.
Narrow the lanes. Well, in the neighborhoods we serve, a along North Meridian Street. We have a bike lane through Capitol and Illinois. At this point, I don't see a lot of bicyclers using it, but, you know, they were just put in. And quite frankly, to be honest, the issues our neighborhoods face and our ability, for instance, to develop and sell new homes, the bike lanes may be helpful, but there's about four or five other more powerful things that influence our success or failure, to be honest. But
and
I
what
think
are,
it could
what
be
are
a,
those things?
Though? Oh, number one is really the economics, to be honest with you. And I think this varies from neighborhood to neighborhood, but, you know, it costs our organization, let's say, $150,000 to buy a severely blighted monstrosity of a home, demolish it. We have the most expensive piece of dirt ever, you know. Then to rebuild a more modern market home, you know, walk-in closets, et cetera, we might spend $150,000 for a home that's going to appraise for $90,000. I mean, just bottom line. So us overcoming that hurdle is way more important. I'm not dissing bike lanes, but I think in terms of rebuilding a neighborhood, we're starting at the economics of making the investment just don't make sense. People buying or not buying, I think in our case, are looking at the modern amenities of the home and the walkability of the neighborhood and is there a park nearby and how safe they feel before they get to the can I bike to work part in that case. Again, I'm not dissing bike lanes to bicyclers out there.
I would add one thing on the bike lanes, and this is pretty soft right now because a lot of people aren't using them, but I do think that you get to that when you see bikers going through neighborhoods that they might not walk in or might not have walked in 3 or 4 years ago, I get a feeling of this is a safer neighborhood than most people realize. And I think bikers that go through there, they start to think, they see the neighborhood for more than just the stoplights they're trying to get through or stop at. They see it for what it is and maybe start to have more of an appreciation for that neighborhood.
Yeah.
The ones close to our office, Michigan, New York, I'm seeing more and more people on them. I hope they have that impact that going from the east side from, you know, pick your street, rural to downtown isn't really scary. You shouldn't be scared of that, although some people, I think, feel that way.
We are talking about redevelopment here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. The theme we keep coming back to here is making people feel safe. I think all three of you have referred to it at one point or another. Is that the primary challenge, Maury Plambeck?
Well, I don't think it's the primary challenge. It's certainly one of the challenges because there is a perception that inner city neighborhoods are not safe. I think some of the challenges that are related are the types of houses that are there. You know, on the near east side, I think there's a lot of two-bedroom, one-bathroom houses, and people don't typically buy those anymore. So how can those houses be turned into something that's more similar than that you can get somewhere else? As Michael talked about, the big houses that are hard to maintain, that's an issue you have to overcome. And then there's mixes of land uses that were done 50 years ago that might not be appropriate now. I think Joe mentioned brownfields, so there's some neighborhoods that have old industrial uses that you might have to deal with if you live there. And so there's all those things together.
How long have you been doing this sort of work, Maury? Because you're speaking.
I've been doing it over 30 years.
Okay, it's okay. You're not going to intimidate the rest of us. We're a mature vintage as well. And I guess what I'd want to ask is, how have the challenges evolved over time? You know, presumably, if you've been doing it for more than 30 years, I know because I was in the city during the 80s, our focus was exclusively as a community, almost all on downtown revitalization at that point. And then, you know, stadium came online, Circle Center Mall, a lot of other things, and that was successful. But, you know, where are the challenges now, and are they easier or harder to meet?
Well, the challenge that I think is the most difficult is the abandoned housing problem that just has really come up in the last several years. It wasn't, I didn't perceive it as much a problem 20 years ago when I first came to Indianapolis.
And you mean as a product of the economic downturn and people basically,
I think that's
real
one
estate
of the
bubble
things,
popping and all of that?
Well, the reason that it's a problem, I believe, is if you're a person that's either has stayed in the neighborhood in your house, or you want to move to the neighborhood, you have to worry now about a property that's not going to be maintained. How does that impact your property value? How does that impact safety? So you have to be concerned about that, whereas a few years ago, you didn't have to be so concerned about it. And so that's something that's different. The retail problem that we talked about, that's been around for years in this city.
And it sounds like Michael Osborne or Joe, either one of you wants to jump in on this, that there's a ripple effect there, too, that when somebody abandons a house, it creates a pressure for others then to be thinking, you know, the neighborhood could be slipping. I need to get out and get my, you know, investment out. Joe Witsit.
It becomes a problem for homeowners and business owners who want to stay there but think maybe I should move my business somewhere else or take my investment and go to the suburbs. It also, frankly, creates a problem even for renters. There are, you know, people who are renting an apartment or a home, they have choices to make also, and they can rent somewhere else. They have young children. They don't want abandoned homes where their children can go play or kids hang out, other kids hang out in and usually are up to no good, you know, in those abandoned homes. So it has a lot of ripples, and the effect can be pretty dramatic in a neighborhood. Once, you know, there are some streets in this city that have 30, 40, 50% of the homes that are vacant. I think that bulge occurred in the economic downturn and the housing crisis and the lending that probably shouldn't have been done in the first place.
I think there's probably a tipping point involved too, because one abandoned house or one vacant home and unmowed lawn on a block isn't so bad. Maybe two isn't so bad, and it's three. But at some point, many neighborhoods hit kind of a tipping point where maybe there's a real loss of confidence. I don't know if that's 8 or 10 or, you know, is it 20% or 30%, but at a certain point, probably there was a panic or a real thought about, do we stay? Do we want to invest here? Because now there's sort of a critical mass of challenge. Again, one or two isn't bad, but when it's 40% of the homes on a block are abandoned, you got to have a lot of resolve to stay or be willing to pioneer and move in a neighborhood like that. And I think that's changed how we have to do what we do.
Well, I guess what I want to ask, is there a ripple effect on the back end, or is it not as effective that once you go in and start reclaiming these pieces of property and restoring, it sounds like the ripple effect can be pretty dynamic on the front end. When you've started doing the work, is it as dynamic on the back end, or is it just a much harder push?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a harder push, but I think Michael indicated earlier, if you target certain areas, that makes it easier. So the Legacy Project on the east side, community center out there and the CDC out there partnered with a number of other not-for-profits and also with the city and made a target of a neighborhood called St. Clair Place. Mm-hmm. And so when you make that target, then when you're marketing it, you're marketing the houses that are being rehabbed or the new construction, you can say, well, the city partnered with new streets and sidewalks and infrastructure. The Realtors Association partnered with some funds. 10th Street has some improvements along it, the commercial part. So all those things together help resell it. And then the other things that help these neighborhoods now, I mean, there is opportunity and there are some good things happening, is people are wanting to move closer to downtown, closer to their work. They're wanting to have more amenities like bike lanes, more options that you don't have if you live out in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. And so that's all helping.
Yes, Joe Witsit.
I was just going to add on the Legacy Project. One thing that it had was a core group of people, like Michael had been talking about, who did stay in that neighborhood. In spite of a lot of blight and a lot of things, negative things that had happened, they stayed in that neighborhood. They had worked on what they called a quality of life plan with the help of Local Initiative Support Corporation here in town. And so they were ready to go when the Legacy Project and the Super Bowl stuff came along. As a group, they had stuck it out. Some people there 40, 50, 60 years. And they were ready to still invest more time and leave their investment in that neighborhood to make it work. And it does take that. A community that, you know, may be listening right now thinking, well, we want that also. It's a lot of work by the community.
And that raises a question, I guess, where I was going with all of this is, are there indicators when a neighborhood or a community is at risk? And would it be better, you know, are there Are there mechanisms for us to intervene at that point and say, rather than waiting for it to fall into complete disrepair or, you know, get to the point where they're 30, 40, 50%? Or is that just something that we're not sophisticated enough to be able to do? Joe Witsito.
So I'll answer the first half if more you might answer the second half. You know, there are indicators, and I know we keep alluding to the east side, but that was a project that I think a lot of us had worked on for the past 3 or 4 years. A leading indicator for the east side was the 46201 area code, led the country in foreclosures in 2005 through 2007. Before 3 years before the housing
collapse.
Crisis,
yeah.
It led in foreclosures, and that was a sign of what was going to happen out there. The lenders, the unsavory lenders, lenders had already been through that neighborhood earlier, and the market had already crashed there beforehand. How to address those concerns? That's a difficult question to answer.
But, yeah, Maury.
Yeah, there's a lot more information now than there was 10 years ago. Even the federal government had a program called the Neighborhood Stabilization Program that was really directed at the abandoned and foreclosed property problems in cities. So Indianapolis got significant funds to help that, and we used demographic data and a lot of citizen input to determine how best to spend those dollars. We also are now looking, and those were pretty much some of the worst areas. As we look in the future, you kind of got to look at areas that have not become so far down, but have some trends towards going down, losing retail maybe or something like that. And that's where we're trying to do planning now and work with those neighborhoods so that new things can happen before it goes down to the bottom.
And, you know, you work at it exclusively from the neighborhood perspective, Michael. Yeah. What are the indicators as far as you can tell?
Well, my time with Near North Development has been, I think, after the indicators, after the warning lights went off, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I do want to, though, echo the idea of kind of making a critical mass of change. Even at our level, it's not an entire neighborhood, but we targeted essentially about 6 square blocks in a neighborhood, and we'll be, by the end of this year, touching about 40% of the properties there, either acquiring, turning into a park, demolishing a blighted building, providing homeowner repair. It was about the philosophy of a critical mass of change in a very concentrated area, which goes back to this kind of building a catalyst, going from band-aiding something here or there to really restoring confidence to people that this is a place to invest. I'm not going to be the only one moving in. That it's rebuilding sometimes the economics of a micro market. But I think that's critical. It was mentioned earlier, but that happens not only by picking an entire neighborhood within the city, but even blocks within a neighborhood can be sort of made over and revitalized in a very permanent, non-Band-Aid kind of way. And that's absolutely critical.
And how did you identify those 6 blocks, that area that you wanted to, what was the process there?
We picked a combination of where there was a core of solid home ownership, because ours was a housing revitalization initiative. So where was there a fair amount of homeowners with some good housing stock, but also where was there a huge amount of opportunity? I guess that's making lemonade out of lemons. That's code for where was the highest concentration of blighted, abandoned, foreclosed properties that we could acquire, mixed in with good, solid home ownership component, not the bad with the not so, you know, with the average. And so where could we make that biggest difference?
We are talking about redevelopment here in Indianapolis on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Maury Plenbeck, who is the director of the Indianapolis Department of Metropolitan Development, Michael Osborne, president of the Near North Development Corporation, and Joe Witsit of the Witsit Group. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about redevelopment in Indianapolis, and my guests are Maury Plambeck, who is the director of the Indianapolis Department of Metropolitan Development, Michael Osborne, who is president of Near North Development Corporation, and Joe Whitsitt, who is with the Whitsitt Group. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, or you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or shoot us a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've got an email question from a listener named Ryan, and it's addressed to all of you. It says, what, if any, plans are on the horizon in terms of necessary policy changes or subsidies which may encourage people to implement energy and water conservation measures and clean energy production and rainwater collection systems such as solar panels or cisterns on small-scale commercial and residential developments, or retrofits for buildings being redeveloped? I think, Maury, probably you're the one who can answer most of those, and then I'll throw it to Joe.
I'm not the expert on that. Probably the best thing to do is call the city's Office of Sustainability. They've been working on those initiatives for a while. I do know that you can get a cheaper permit price if you do things like that, and in the long run, it's just good for the city.
Mm-hmm. Is it a focus for you, Joe, and your work? Or is it?
It is, and really in two ways. And I know a little bit about what the caller or the email's asking, because on one of our properties, we did put in solar panels and a geothermal heating system and got federal tax credits for those. And there are federal tax credits available for those for a business or for an individual, for your home. The IPL has a reverse metering or program also, where they'll put a meter in for you if you have either a wind turbine or you have solar panels, so that they can, you know, that they can help you use that. It just ties right into their grid system. The on the rental side, rental properties that use affordable housing tax credits, the Indiana Housing Community Development Authority has very strong programs encouraging developers of affordable housing to use all Energy Star appliances, roofing materials, water conservation devices. So to the extent that the people are interested in renting properties, those units are usually some of the most efficient housing in the city.
We are talking about redevelopment in Indianapolis here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Walter, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. Regarding the this calming effect of traffic, have the bike lanes reduced the number of traffic lanes?
I'll go with you on that one, Maury.
I don't think so. I think what the Department of Public Works did when they created those was narrowed the lanes as opposed to reducing the lanes. Now, there is a thought nationally in some instances that you minimize the number of lanes on different streets and put in bike lanes and things like that. And there might be a couple of examples here, but I'm not aware of them.
And Capitol and Kenwood, through the area we serve, were the same way. It just narrowed the lanes.
Yeah, and that's been my perception driving. Thank you very much for the call and the question, Walter. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Eric. Says, Maury, and this one's directed to you, ask what the city is doing to reduce the surplus of housing in Marion County. The U.S. Census data shows that Marion County has nearly 418,000 housing units and only 357,000 households, creating a surplus in excess of 60,000 housing units. This surplus destroys any hope of getting any return on investment from redeveloping a property. Is that accurate? I'll start with Maury, and then Joe, I think probably you could speak to that one as well.
Generally speaking, I do think it is accurate that there are more housing units than there are families moving into them, which is one of the struggles you have trying to have people move back in the inner city. I think of that as a regional problem as opposed to just the city of Indianapolis problem, because we don't have anything that stops you from buying a house in Hamilton County, for example. So really our programs are multifaceted, working with community development corporations and neighborhoods to try to make them more livable and something that people would choose, as opposed to going out somewhere where there's a new house already built somewhere else. The mayor, as you know, has been working on the Rebuild Indy program that includes the demolition of the worst of the housing. We work with the Health and Hospital Corporation to demolish houses that are already falling down. Mm-hmm. We've been behind in that process because of funding. And so with the Rebuild Indy, we're working with the worst of those. We've also, on the other hand, been working with several neighborhood leaders about trying to save some of the best of those for people to restore if they find someone to do that.
And is that, in some cases, is that, you know, actually an acceptable redevelopment strategy is you just knock it down? And
I don't think the demolition in itself is a good redevelopment strategy. That's happened all over the country. It even happened here, and it took forever for Fall Creek Place to be redeveloped, for example. It's only good if it's part of other strategies where the rest of the houses that are either lived in or not in a sad state can be rehabbed and reused. It's only good as an overall strategy.
But it does address the
Michael Osborne,
supply
yes.
and demand dynamic and
part of what we've been talking about are first changes in, for lack of a better term, technology with the development of the car, but also market forces that have created mm-hmm. a lot of these. To some degree, it sounds to me, and I know probably about a hundredth of what all of you do on all of this, that the only hope for that is figuring out some way to harness those same forces for redevelopment. We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Shannon who wants to know about the importance of working with neighborhood associations while redeveloping a community. Michael Osborne.
Wow. Well, that's absolutely important, and it's a core of Near North Development Corporation and our peers across the city. We're directed by boards that are made up of neighborhood association, residents, et cetera. I think there's a real partnership to be had where, you know, as community development corporations, we're sort of professional staff. We can manage the technical challenges. We're really good at certain things, mm-hmm. implementing certain things. But there's a lot of things that certainly neighborhood associations and residents can set the priorities better than a staff can. There are neighborhood associations who are on the ground, eyes on the street, et cetera. That makes them good at certain things that organizations like ours are not as mm-hmm. good at. So really, both from getting input in what our priorities should be and in partnering programmatically, I think that's what we have to focus on.
Tony, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you. This is a great program.
Oh, thank you. Your question, please.
My question is, I live on the northeast side. I've lived in Indianapolis for the last 25 years, and I've noticed that the area, Keystone South of Fall Creek, all the way to I-70, fluctuates between blight and sometimes stable. But what is being done from the perspective of increasing the flow or the access to I-70? Can something be done by repossessing or maybe eminent domain of some of the properties that are destroyed to give motorists a better access to the I-70 corridor?
Good question. Thank you very much for the call, Tony.
You're welcome.
Well, Maury, I think we'll start with you on that one, although I think, just judging from the body language here, I don't think anyone's got a definitive answer on it. But
yeah,
we'll start
I think
there.
Best people to talk to are the transportation planners in the Metropolitan Planning Organization, and they're in our department, but they do the long-range planning for streets and other modes of transportation. And the other option is to talk to the Department of Public Works, who would actually do physical improvements to the streets.
Well, and I probably, while we're talking about this, you know, one of the big subjects that is preoccupying central Indiana right now is the development of a mass transit system. Would that be a good thing for neighborhood revitalization or a bad thing? Michael Osborne.
I think it's been proven in cities across the country that a very efficient, effective transit system and sort of multimodal transit system mm-hmm. really is a huge driver for neighborhood revitalization, very much where that train stop goes, where multiple modes intersect. That is a nexus. That's a draw to folks like Joe and others who are doing development. No question.
Joe Whitsitt, yeah.
Yeah, that's, Michael, you're exactly right. That's definitely a draw for us. And the other thing that it does for a company like mine or for our residents is if we do a development in the inner city, that a good transportation system provides better employment opportunities for those residents who right now, maybe they live, at 16th and College, but they have more job opportunities if there's an easier way or a faster way or just any way for them to get to a job that's not walking distance or not an hour to get there. Yeah. So it could really have a positive impact on what is built in that neighborhood, plus the overall economic health of the people who live there.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Mike who asks about the importance of green space. So it's user-friendly and the incorporation of arts like waterwork features, sculptures, etc. How important are they in terms of revitalization? Michael Osborne.
I think the quality of life is huge. On one hand, somebody moving into a neighborhood is looking at the home they're going to buy or the apartment they're going to rent and where they might shop. But depending on your particular interests, it could be recreation, green space, place for the family to play. Those are increasingly recognized by organizations like ours as kind of critical to community development. So making sure that's there, trails, recreation opportunities, parks, are important at our scale, certainly.
David, welcome to the program.
Yes. Has anyone considered appealing to or advertising to the homeschooling community, which has an annual conference at least once a year, in that this group is not dependent or concerned or focused on moving the family out to a suburb because of access to that suburban school? The homeschoolers, it seems to me, would be ideal candidates for the Center City housing arrangements. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call, David. Joe Whitsitt.
Actually, I had not considered that. That's a very good idea.
So you're glad you came to the program today.
I'm here. No, that makes a lot of sense because you're right. I was going to mention earlier, you don't want to be the one to bring up inner city redevelopment and schools and that being a problem. But to the extent that some people think that is a problem because they don't homeschool and they don't send their kids to a private school, then you're right. How someone feels about or what they think about the education system we have here in Indianapolis has a definite impact on the development in our inner city neighborhood. So, no, I think that's a very good point.
Ruff, welcome to the program.
Yes. My question is regarding I live over on the near northwest side over on Cold Springs Road, which is a very heavily bike-traveled area. In fact, in the afternoon after 5, we probably get 150 bicycles. Mm-hmm. And when the piping project came through, they rebuilt that road. And I asked about trying to put a bike lane in because people drive too fast and it's really a hazard. And yet, I was told there was no funding and I wondered how you get consideration for something like that.
Good question. Thank you very much for the call, Ruff. Well, I'll start with Maury on that.
Yeah, you should contact the Office of Sustainability. They have a person there that I can't remember his name right now, but he really works on the bike lanes. And certainly,
is there a phone number at the Office of Sustainability?
You have to go to the city's website,
okay.
And it's in the Department of Public Works.
How about if we give them the URL then, real quickly, for the city's website?
Indy.gov.
It's a test.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the funding for it certainly has increased under Mayor Ballard. That is one of his priorities. And so, hopefully they can find something for your street.
So
there.
Make a call and figure that out. Is that an issue that you see in other places besides he was referencing Cold Springs Road that, you've got a heavy bike, your wits it?
Well, I wasn't specifically thinking about biking. I was just thinking about the city funding in general is tight, and we all know that. And whether it's a bike lane or new sidewalks or just a road that needs to be resurfaced, which is a bad example because almost all of them were resurfaced in the past 12 months, or a lot of them were. But, city funding's tight, and it takes, the developers or the CDCs like Near North Development Corp, we all have to figure out how we can help on that or do that ourselves sometimes or, how you get that done because it's just hard to – you can't do every street everywhere.
I see we've got a call with a good question that's on point, refers to the mass transit thing. And rather than take the call, I'm just going to try to synthesize the question. Are there any plans for mass transit from the airport that we're aware of, and what effect would that have on redevelopment?
Well, the Indy Connect plan has general routes for the whole Central Indiana region, and there is a route along Washington Street that would be able to connect to the airport. That all depends on if the city, decides to have mass transit, and that would happen after we voted on that.
We have pretty much come to the end of our conversation today. I really would like to thank all of you. I think we could have gone for another couple hours on this pretty easily. I'd like to thank Maury Plambeck, who is the director of the Indianapolis Department of Metropolitan Development. Maury, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for spending this time with
us. You're welcome.
Also like to thank Michael Osborne, who is the president of Near North Development Corporation. I made it through without actually slipping a side in there anywhere. Michael, thank you for spending this time.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
We greatly appreciate it. And Joe Witsit, developer with the Witsit Group. I'm assuming that the Witsit Group is your brainchild, pretty much.
Yes, it is. Myself and my son, actually. Okay. So yes. Yeah.
Joe, thank you very much for spending this time with us.
Thank you.
I also would like to thank all of our listeners who called in and sent in great questions. We will be back next week when we're going to be talking about bullying in the workplace with both experts and victims. I hope you'll join us then. Until then, please have a great week. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Take care.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Public Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday at 1 p.m. for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.